my name is Heather Shapiro, and I'm here with Michael Perry. We're at CodeMash 2016 in Sandusky, Ohio, and we're going to learn about ways to prevent code abuse. So if you could tell me a little bit more about your talk, that'd be great.
Okay, it's pretty cool. So a lot of times you are creating code that not just you yourself are going to use, but you want other people to use, people on your team. Maybe it's an open source project. And so you want to make sure that that when they take your code and they use it, that they're going to use it correctly. And a lot of things that we see in the .NET framework or in open source, they give you a documentation how you're supposed to use it, but you're not really forced down that path. You can use it incorrectly, and then that'll just lead to all kinds of bugs.
Yeah, that's definitely an issue I've run into in the past where you download something and you're like, oh, this is how it should be used, mm-hmm. but you never get to that point of how it can be used. Like,
yeah.
They don't tell you what to install, or you just don't have all the information that you need to know, so mm-hmm. it's impossible to use. And you're like, well, this was useless for me to download.
Yeah, and it's actually pretty simple. There are just a few simple techniques that you can do to make sure that somebody who's using your library is going to use it correctly. Like one of the things that you often see documented is that you have to call this method to put this object in this state before you can call this other method. And if you don't have the object in the right state, then usually what the API will end up doing is just throwing an exception.
Gotcha.
And exceptions just make you afraid to touch things. It's kind of like playing a game of operation. You just have to be really careful about how you touch that API. But instead, you can use the compiler itself mm-hmm. to prove a theorem about the code that you're writing. You prove that you've set the object into the correct state before you've called that method.
Okay, so how do you prove that?
One of the techniques is that we can just simply use parameters. So here in this code, I've got a shopping service where I can call begin transaction and then add an item to a cart. And the API here is expecting me to have a transaction running before I add an item to the cart. And if I don't, then let's say it's just going to throw an exception. Well, we can improve this by instead, let's go ahead and have begin transaction return the actual transaction. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And then if we pass the transaction into add to cart, then there's no way for me to call add to cart without having first called begin transaction.
Gotcha. Okay, so what kind of response does it tell you?
There's the right way to use things where mm-hmm. I begin the transaction first.
Okay.
And then I can add it to the cart. So the right way I can change to take this transaction and pass it in. But the wrong way, if I forget to call begin transaction, then I don't have a transaction object, and that code won't even compile.
Yep. So, okay, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll just spit out an error.
Right, right.
Awesome. So tell me a little bit more about the other techniques.
Some of the other techniques, like one technique I like to use is callbacks. A lot of times you'll have some code that you need to call on the API, and then you put your code in, and then you call some more API code.
Mm-hmm.
So yours is kind of sandwiched in between. Well, if you are trying to use the API correctly, then you have to remember all the code that you have to write around your code. Whereas if instead the API were written to take that part in the middle as a callback, a delegate or a lambda expression,
gotcha.
Then you could just pass that as a function, and then it would do things in the right order. And so now you're, again, having the compiler prove that you're doing things properly, because the only thing that you can do that will compile is to pass a function that has the proper signature.
So it's making it much more user-friendly mm-hmm. for everyone else to use, which is,
right.
I guess, the point. Yeah, so your coworkers could then take the code and be able to just, or take some of your API, put it in, and put what you actually need in, and mm-hmm. not mess up any of the other code.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
a lot of times you'll see there's an API that has like a fluent interface.
Mm-hmm.
You call one method and then you hit dot, and now there's a list of other methods you can call. So you call one of those methods, hit dot, and now there's another list of methods
mm-hmm.
you can call. And fluent interfaces are a great way of guiding somebody into the pit of success. You just fall into the correct usage of the API. So create that API with the right fluent interface,
mm-hmm.
and now people can't help but use it correctly. If they try to use it incorrectly, it's not even going to compile.
That makes sense. And then usually what I see is like you'll do dot, and it tells you the next one, and then in parentheses it tells you exactly what you need.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost dummy proof. It tells you exactly what you're missing, like if you need an int instead of a float or stuff like that.
Yeah.
Awesome, cool.
Yeah.
Recently I have been using callbacks. I use like Twilio API and then MongoDB, they have callbacks. And
yes.
It took me a while to figure out just how to, because you don't actually have to run the function, and then there's always so many errors. So, it was, but once you figure it out, it's like pretty easy, and you really just need that like one simple line, and then everything runs and works perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, awesome. It's all kind of magical. And there's a technique that people might have heard the name of called monads. It really comes from functional programming. It's a really scary sounding concept, but as it turns out, monads are a really powerful way to prove that you're doing something correctly, because a monad is really just an augmented value. Mm-hmm. So you're taking the value, if you've got a list of customer objects. You're taking that customer value, and now you're augmenting it with other things that are happening around it. So maybe you're getting that list from a database. So there might be information about did that database call succeed or fail inside of that monad. And so you're just augmenting that value, and now you're able to put it into a pipeline where you can now transform that customer into maybe their orders, and then into maybe the customer status and the price that they're going to pay. You do that in a pipeline, and now all of that extra stuff about the database status is kind of just encapsulated within that monad. So so that's kind of where all of these techniques lead up to is really how to create monads in C# in order to prove that you're using an API correctly.
So how do you prove it? Are you doing going both bidirectionally? Like, are you doing like math, algorithms, discrete math, or are you just proving it? Like, how are you proving it?
Well, that's the beauty of it. The compiler itself is a really strong proof, theorem prover.
Okay.
So the compiler's doing all the hard work for you. All you're doing is you're expressing your assertions, what you expect to be true.
What you need.
To the compiler. And you're doing that in terms of type signatures. You're doing that in terms of the parameters and the return values of functions. And so so if you just think about these things not in terms of, I have to do something, so I have to call a function, but rather in terms of what has to happen first? Okay, those are going to be the parameters. What can happen later? Okay, those will be the methods. What can follow that? Those will be the return values. You start to think about things in those terms, structure the API, and then you'll just kind of let the compiler do the proof for you.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, so you have to know exactly what you want in the end, I guess.
Yes.
You can't just start coding and be like, whatever comes out.
Yeah.
So you have to know exactly what you want then. Figure out like a plan of how to get there.
Yeah, a plan definitely does help.
Awesome. So what else will we be talking about in your talk?
We talked about parameters, callbacks, factories. Oh, factories are a really important one, because usually somebody will provide maybe just a class that has some properties on it, and so you can create that class, set the properties, and so you might set that class in an invalid state. Well, instead, if you took away the constructor, you just made it private, you took away all of the property setters, so you can't change the class itself. And instead, you just provide factory methods. So you have to call a factory method in order to get a value of this type. Now you've proven that the only way, if you have a value of this type, then it is valid, because you called a factory to get it. And something that goes along with that, immutability. After you've called that factory, you haven't changed the object. Yeah, you can prove that if your object is immutable, and you tell the compiler that you want it to prove that the object is immutable by making everything read-only.
Okay, perfect. So when other people get it, then they can't change the object, they just have to use exactly what you give them.
Yep, exactly.
So how easy is that for people to, I guess, as a user, how easy is it for someone to understand?
Yeah, as a user of the API, it actually ends up being much easier than using an API that wasn't written in this way, because the IntelliSense just kind of guides you into what you need to do. Mm-hmm. As a library author, you do have to switch your thinking into a different style. So a lot of times we are focused on happy path, let's make something work, and as we're doing that as a library author, we're going to be ignoring all the things that could go wrong, and so that might lead to an API that's harder to use. But if you shift your mind thinking into this is exactly how I expect this API to be used, and so you do have to think about that a little bit ahead of time, then then you can produce something that the compiler will do the proof for you.
Cool. And so would you say this like also works for production level code? Would you say it's the same?
Yeah, I use this in production level code when working with teams because the other members of my team are consumers of my API. So, yeah, one thing that you do as a member of a team is write unit tests, do code reviews, and these are good ways to catch bugs that have already been written. But if you say, okay, I've produced this set of helper classes to help us with Entity Framework. And so if we use this set of helper classes, then I've already proven that you are not leaking data context or something like that. So you bake that proof into the API layer that you put on top of Entity Framework and that you use as a team. And now you don't have to be so strict about code reviews, because if somebody's using it, then they're using it correctly.
Perfect. So that makes it super easy for everyone. It's just a different way of thinking, I guess, as a developer to make it. So what made you get interested in this, or how did you come up with these six ways to prevent abuse?
Yeah, I'm really interested in mathematics. That's my background. That's my passion and my love. And so I always look for ways that I can use math in software. I see software as really just applied mathematics. When doing functional programming, it's pretty natural. This is actually the way that you just naturally program when you're working in a functional language. When you're in an object-oriented language, people don't often think in these ways. So really what I wanted to do was take the concepts that are so familiar in functional programming that are based on mathematics and just apply them to OO and teach them to people in a way that is already familiar to them as an object-oriented developer.
So what is the main goal that you hope that your audience will get out of your talk?
The main goal is that I would like them to be a better member of the development community in terms of producing code that that they can feel more confident in. Different ways that we can gain confidence, like I said before, unit testing, code reviews, that sort of thing. But if they can gain confidence through the mathematical proof that the compiler already gives them, then that will help them.
Yeah. So whenever you see something with math or in statistics, and it gives you something that's like, this is 100% correct, you're like, okay, I got it. Like, you know that it's right. Or like, it gives it a more value to if it's working.
Yeah, there aren't too many guarantees in life, but a mathematical proof is one of those things.
Exactly, yeah. Awesome, cool. So your talk is tomorrow?
Yes, that is
so
correct.
So you excited? Have you given this talk before?
Yeah, this is actually one of my favorite talks, although the last time I gave it, it was only four ways to prevent code abuse.
Okay, so how'd you come up with those last two ways?
The last two ways was really that I'd noticed a glaring omission that I hadn't had immutability in the four ways.
Okay.
And I was like, well, everything should be immutable. It just should be a given, so I just added that in there. As I started learning functional programming and learning about monads and how they work, I realized that all of these other techniques are kind of leading you up to using monads. I tried to come up with ways, like you've seen people talk about, what is a monad? A monad is a burrito, or a monad is an endo function over whatever. And it's like, I don't want to teach people category theory in order to help them become better programmers. How can we talk about the value and the power of monads without having to teach you all the theory?
All the
first.
Math, all the theory. Yeah.
And so I realized this is the perfect avenue because I've already given you some techniques, and those techniques already roll into monads so well. So you're already really close to it. It's just adding one more thing at the end of that in order to chain these together, and you've got something that you can use that's really powerful.
So what's your background before this? Did you have that really bad project that you worked on with a team that made you like passionate about this?
I do have a team in mind that I remember reviewing their code and I found the same kinds of mistakes over and over again. Mm-hmm. So actually I'd started a lunch and learn type of conversations in order to say, okay, I'm seeing these problems. Let's talk about some theory and how we can do this code better. After starting those lunch and learns, after about 3 or 4 sessions, then I started to see some real improvement there. It didn't hurt that I was actually taking some of the code that they had written and showing those during lunch and learns and saying, let's refactor this, let's make this better. Mm-hmm.
This is wrong. Yeah. Like, I can't use this.
So on the one hand, I was shaming my team members, which is something that I never want to do. But mm-hmm. But they understood that it was with love as a member of the team that we want to get better as a collective.
Yeah.
And those lunch and learns eventually became the QED Code brand. My blog, my podcast, and the foundation for a lot of the talks that I get.
So how many people would attend those lunch and learns?
That was about 10 to 15 folks. Mm-hmm.
And how long, are they still going on? Do you still do them?
I'm no longer at that company.
Oh, okay.
And,
gotcha.
After I left, actually, I had the chance to go back. And so we had sort of as a consultant. And so I had the chance to do a lunch and learn with them. By that time, there was kind of this, it became kind of this, rumor or this stigma, like, hey, we used to do this QED code thing, and now Michael's back, and so
let's try again.
There I got 30-35 people at that lunch session, people that I had never met before, and it's like, yeah, let's go.
So everyone heard about
stuff.
You knew about those. That's awesome. Uh-huh. Cool. So what else are you looking to get out of CodeMash? Have you been to going to a lot of talks?
I had been to that conference a couple of times.
Okay.
And I really wanted to see what it was that had inspired Clark Sell to put on that conference. And so, I'm looking forward to seeing the community and the vibe that that happens here. And so far with the pre-compilers, it's definitely been a lot of fun. But as we get into the sessions, I understand it's going to get really crazy.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot more people here tomorrow and next day, but it should be awesome. Mm-hmm. This is my first time at CodeMash as well, so
cool.
It's fun to see all the developers. But very different than going to like a businessy corporate conference. It's much more relaxed. Everyone's much more, I guess, outgoing, like mm-hmm. willing to teach, and it's much more of a collective community. I found, not just like open source. I guess it's just become so large now, so big now that. It's a very welcoming community, which I really like.
Yeah, and I love the fact that families are invited to join. We've got the Kids Mash sessions. My wife was able to come with me, so she's enjoying the hospitality of the Kalahari while we're in session. It's just a lot of fun.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to interview with us. I hope you have a great rest of your CodeMash.
All right, thanks. I appreciate it.
Thank you.